I'll show you politics in America. Here it is, right here. I think the puppet on the right shares my beliefs. I think the puppet on the left is more to my liking. Hey, wait a minute. There's one guy holding up both puppets. Shut up. Go back to bed, America. Your government is in control.
Read my lips.
Just send your cash.
There has never been so many lies, so much deception.
Doesn't anyone notice this? I feel like I'm taking crazy pills.
Please clap.
It's time for the Mike Madison Show, a new breed of conservative talk. Now, here's your host, Mike Madison.
Showtime!
All right, good morning. Welcome to the Mike Madison Show here at 103.9 WYAB, here weekdays 9 to 11 o'clock, offering you up a safe space for you independent thinkers out there. And I'm going to need you next hour. We'll see how independently you think, how intellectually, how willing you are to question assumptions. Next hour, we're going to have Christina Dent in here. She runs an organization called End It for Good. And she is possibly one of the best spokespeople I've ever seen for questioning the war on drugs, on its effectiveness, on its results, on its costs. She pretty much covers it, and she's having a conference. There's some great keynote speakers, and she's written a report looking at actually the cost to the state of Mississippi in particular, which is something that I don't think I've ever seen, certainly done at a state level. I've read a lot of things about this. Now, I do a lot on this topic and don't know it's always that popular, but I think it's important because if you've got a policy that really ensnares a lot of people and has meant a lot for our privacy, for dangers to law enforcement, to bad results for our citizens, for the fact that we are the most incarcerated country on planet Earth. I think all of these things are wildly important. And certainly, you know, I think a lot of people out there would say we should rethink the way we do education. And so I think that that's something we should think about. I think we should rethink our foreign policy, the United States. It's obviously a disaster. And drug policies in the United States and the way we've approached it have also been a train wreck. And so if you want to get down to some of these, I talked about it the other day. You want to stop violence in this country? Everybody's pointing to the murder numbers in Jackson, Chicago. We know the problems with inner city gangs across the country. You want to stop these things, then you need to change. I mean, we need to look at everything, don't we? And I think this is an important issue, and Christina's just a fantastic spokesperson for it. She's just one of the most solid people I know, so you're not going to be hearing some hippie that's just got a peace sign up in the air saying legalize drugs. She's just talking about it, changing the way that we approach the topic and the effects that it could have if we took a different tact. We should all want the best things for our country. We should even want the best things for those people who get stuck in cycles of addiction. And what we're doing now is traumatizing those people and just assuring. I'll have to get Christina to tell me who this is because I talk about it all the time. But one expert said if you were trying to create a system that created the most addicts, you would create the American system the way it's currently enacted. So anyway, we'll talk to Christina Dent next hour. She's been on the show a couple of times and she and I did a podcast together for a while, too, so we've talked a lot about this issue, and she's just, you're not going to find anybody who understands the topic better than Christina, so stick around with us for that. I've got some quotes of the day today. Go ahead and get to these. I'll be honest with you, I got into the studio about 3 minutes too late. That's a world of time when when your show's starting. I'm scrambling trying to get everything situated here. I wasn't late to the station. I'm always early to the station. Just sometimes I get a little, I dawdle a little bit before coming into the studio. Here is Jean-Jacques Rousseau says, "Free people remember this maxim. We may acquire liberty, but it is never recovered once it's lost." To all of you people out there excited about all the COVID protocols, vaccine mandates, understand, we will not get autonomy over our bodies back if you give it to people now. Even if you do it willingly. You've always got the opportunity to do that willingly, but if you cheer for mandates and laws and restrictions on personal privacy and personal autonomy, you will regret that. Mark my words. Augustine said, people hate the truth for the sake of whatever it is they love more than the truth. They love truth when it shines warmly on them and hate it when it rebukes them. Part of our long-running theme here, if people only really believe and think truth is whatever they already believe. Very few people open-minded, but I think that this show has attracted a lot of people willing to consider other things. And then this one from Aldous Huxley. This is, he wrote a letter to George Orwell back in 1949. He said, within the next generation, I believe that the world's rulers will discover that infant conditioning and narco-hypnosis are more efficient as instruments of government than clubs and prisons, and that the lust for power can be just as completely satisfied by suggesting people into loving their servitude as by flogging and kicking them into obedience. And how many people do you know out there right now that are just, they want to see everybody mask mandate? All of these things they've been forced to do, they have embraced wholeheartedly. They love their servitude. They love being bossed around. They want more bossing around, more restrictions, because they're scared to live their own lives. They have become loving of their servitude. And it's interesting, in this quote, again, this is from 1949. It's one of the things that I don't think I'd seen this before. He talks about infant conditioning and narco-hypnosis. This really hits on two things the show talks about a lot. One is the infantilization of the entire country to a government that says that they know best for you. I've asked, I don't know how Democrats get up and put their pants on by themselves. I don't know if there's a manual or if some state worker comes by and helps you put your pants on. But they've convinced you can't do anything without the government. And then there's the narco-hypnosis, which is the over-medication of the United States, particularly when it comes to the psychotropic drugs. And God knows what's in the vaccines. I was talking to a friend last night in Nashville. I was really sad. She's got a mom in a care home up there, and her mom's just not getting good care. There are new people constantly. The staff turnover. There's no consistency, which elderly people need. And this is largely because of all kinds of things. The policies around COVID that's made the job more difficult. And, of course, vaccine mandates that are coming down. I think they've got people that are quitting right now because they're about to be forced to take the jab, or many of them already have. And, you know, you look at, I was just talking to her last night and going on yesterday, talking about the labor market. We've been talking about police leaving the force, talking about hospitals with staffing issues that sacrifice care. There is no way that the people in charge, everybody from Fauci to Thomas Dobbs to governors to mayors to the medical community, there's no way these people in charge of the policies that led us here don't know the damage that they're causing. There's just simply no way. I have almost given Thomas Dobbs some credit for thinking he's just a psychopath with a singular focus, that he can't see the rest of the world. He's just laser beam focused on this one microscopic virus. And he doesn't notice the child suicides. He doesn't notice the kids falling behind in school. He doesn't notice the isolation of the elderly. He doesn't notice people dying alone. All of the knock-on consequences of all these COVID policies. But there is just no way at this point that these people who seek to control every single thing cannot see the consequences of the policies that have been enacted over the last 18 months will far and away exceed any damage that virus would have done by itself had they not even told us it existed. If we had just been told, look out, buckle up, if you're elderly, if you're obese, this is going to be a bad flu season for you. Had they said that and then sit down and shut up, we would be better off than we are right now. Not one of the mitigation efforts has worked. Masks don't work. Lockdowns don't work. Forcing restaurants to only have 25% occupancy for 6 months doesn't work. Closing places down at 10 o'clock and having curfews doesn't work. None of these things have worked. And we would have just been so much better had they not even mentioned this thing to us. But, you know, nursing homes, again, just another one to put into the list of consequences of yielding to these people. It is just unbelievable. And I don't know. We know Bill Gates, he's talked about population reduction. That's not a conspiracy theory. He said it. And Bill Gates has even said, wish I had the clip handy. He said vaccination will get us to population reduction. A bit of a paraphrase there, but that's exactly what he said. If we want to control the population, We can do it through vaccines. This was always a very mystifying statement that he made, but he did make this statement out of his mouth, not secondhand. I've seen it. I've heard it. So there is that. There's profiteering. The motives are diverse, but the consequences of what we've seen, they're ripping our society apart now, particularly over the vaccine issue. And when I come back, somebody famous has weighed in on the vaccine issue. Somebody near and dear to everybody's heart. I got to tell you. So stick with me. I'm about to do a very unpopular segment when I come back. They say you better listen to the wise side of reason, but they don't give you any choice because they think that it's treason. So you had better do what you All right, here I go. Listenership to this radio station, I think, has gone way up over the last 6 to 9 months, particularly because we seem to be the only outlet out there, be it the TV stations, the radio stations around here that are kind of resisting what we all at this radio station seem to see as some pretty insane times. That this is not normal, to just go along to get along does not seem like the path to take. Podcast numbers have been going up. You can find the podcast at themikemadisonshow.podbean.com. I'm getting more emails than I had before. You can email me, mikemadison@wyeb.com, and then I'll do a segment like this and risk tanking it all. But I cannot stay silent. Apparently, Donald Trump went to the warmonger Bill O'Reilly's show. Where is he doing a show now? I guess Bill O'Reilly is attempting to make a comeback. I may have already lost some people right there by challenging Bill O'Reilly. I am no fan. No fan. It's called The First TV. I don't know exactly what that is, but it's Bill O'Reilly. So Donald Trump goes on with Bill O'Reilly. And they got around to talking shots. I'm sure Bill O'Reilly is a pusher of the jabs. And this is what I talked about yesterday. The Republican thing is, oh, these things are fantastic. You need to rush out and get them. But we don't want to force anybody to take it. They're still fine with the mass experimentation on the American people. But they just, you know, they're the good guys because they won't force you to take it. Now, there is something to be said for that. I appreciate anybody who resists a mandate. People are talking about Andy Gibson actually mandating no mandates. So there's some value to not being forced to do this. But so here's what Donald Trump had to say on Bill O'Reilly's show. And talking about the problem of President Biden's vaccine credibility. Donald Trump says, quote, I would sell it to them. Talking about us, the rubes out here, who just are hesitant or resist to get it. Donald Trump said he would sell it to you. He added that when he was president, there was no talk of vaccine mandates. And he added that in under 9 months, his administration helped produce not one, but three vaccines, all of which have proven to be the industry standard around the world. Here's his quotes. I wouldn't say to anybody, you have to. But I would sell it. Look, I'm very proud of what we did with the vaccines. It was supposed to take 5 years, and they said it wasn't going to work. I did three vaccines in less than 9 months, and they do work. They work really well. I would convince, again, this is Trump talking. He said, I would convince people, take it. I don't want to push it. When I was president, there was no talk about mandates or anything. Everybody wanted the vaccine. Now a lot of people don't want it. So this is Donald Trump telling you he'd sell you on it. He's the great marketer, I got to tell you, you want this guy back? Now, what a lot of people are saying on this, I've seen it in comment sections. I've heard it from people where they say, I love Trump, but I disagree with him on this issue. This issue, this is the issue. They are doing the largest experimentation on humankind in the history of the world. This issue? Are there really others right now? I got a text from a friend of mine this morning. Now, it's just an antidote. When she was talking to her mom, her mom's had three friends who have mysteriously died in the past couple of weeks. A couple of them in their 40s. Now, people die. But these were sudden deaths. They were all fully vaccinated. I don't know if that's what it was, but we suspect one, a healthy 40-year-old, just suddenly dropped dead of a stroke unexpectedly. So I don't have a whole lot of patience for people who say, oh, I, Trump 2024, I really like Donald Trump. I mean, I disagree with him on the vaccine stuff. Has Trump's advisors not told him about VAERS? Is it not important that the guy who says, who was president of the United States, that ushered in Operation Warp Speed, and that is asking probably for your vote again in 2024, is it too much to ask that one of his advisors just slide by and show him the VAERS reports that show tens of thousands of Americans dead or disabled from these vaccines? Maybe they could slip him the report from Center for, what is it, Medicare Studies, or where they show 45,000 people have died from this shot that he is so proud of. And he's so proud he got this Operation Warp Speed that they said it was going to take 5 years. Yeah, you know who the they was? It was the people who said, yeah, we need to develop a vaccine, and then we need to test it for several years to make sure it's long-term safety. And I guess Trump said, screw the long-term safety studies. Get this thing into arms. I've got a re-election to win. This issue, you like Donald Trump except for this little small issue, giant medical experiment that is killing tens of thousands of Americans, just that little issue. And so I don't know if his advisors are not telling him what's going on. Maybe he's not seeing the Israeli data that shows that as soon as they got vaccinated with one of his vaccines, the one he says work really, really well, they became the world's COVID hotspot. And now they're on their third doses, expecting their fourth doses. So maybe he's not studying that. Maybe he's not looking at the numbers from Great Britain, from Australia. Maybe he doesn't know that the CDC and the FDA lie every time they open their mouth. Maybe he's not aware that Anthony Fauci isn't a good guy. What Trump has said about Anthony Fauci, he said, oh, he's a nice guy. We get along, but I just disagree with him on a few things. This is the Fauci that led us down this path under Donald Trump. But it's just that one issue, Mike. He's so much better on the other. What he's better than Biden? Is that where we're landing now? That pretty much seems to be where. He's better than Joe Biden. I mean, a potted plant is better than Joe Biden. I would vote for a ham sandwich before I would vote for Joe Biden. But I'd also vote for a ham sandwich before I'd vote for Donald Trump again. Again, I told you. Click, click, click. I'm risking any of the newfound popularity that this little show has got between 9 and 11. But just, I disagree with Donald Trump on this issue. This is a huge issue. But he thinks he could sell it to you rubes out there who are hesitant. He doesn't understand your hesitancy. And now, he may not be aware of the VAERS system. He may not be aware of the Israeli data, of the German data, of the Scottish data, of the Gibraltar data, of the all of these other places where the vaccine is just showing failure. It's not containing this virus. And you know, the thing about Trump that really drives me insane that I don't think people appreciate, or maybe they just don't see it the way I do, the Swedish prime minister was able to resist the COVID hysteria. And this strong leader we had, this great American Donald Trump, he wasn't as strong as the Swedish prime minister. The Swedish authorities got a lot of heat from Europe, from the rest of the world, for not taking COVID seriously enough. They wouldn't do lockdowns. They wouldn't do mask mandates. They let their kids go to school. They took a lot of heat for that. Their health minister has come out quite often and said, you know, I think we've been proven right, but everybody told us we were just going to have mass deaths here. We didn't see that, so we left everything open. We still rode the subways without a mask. They did everything like normal life, and they were proven correct. Donald Trump folded like a cheap tent. Oh, he made some comments to the contrary, right? But this is what set us on this path. Now, I'm no Joe Biden fan. If you just tuned in and you think they stuck a leftist, a Democrat in this chair for one show a day, you're dead wrong. Joe Biden is a demented, corrupt old fool. But Donald Trump trying to sell you on this, he thinks he could sell it to you. Because Donald Trump has sold a lot of Americans a lot of things. You remember draining the swamp? He sold that. Did he do it? No, no, he didn't. But he sold you on the idea that maybe just around the corner someday, possibly behind the scenes, he was... he was actually hiring the swamp, but he sold you on that stuff. Now, he may not be aware of VAERS. He may not be aware of all the data around the world that shows that these vaccines are not working, that they're dangerous. He may not be aware of Robert Malone. He may not be aware of Peter McCullough. He may not be aware of all of these other things. I do guarantee you he is aware of one thing, though. He's aware of the over $1 million that Big Pharma gave him for his inauguration. Facing acute risk to their businesses from Washington, D.C., policymakers, health companies spent more than $2 million to buy access to the incoming Trump administration via candlelight dinners, black tie balls, and other U.S. presidential inauguration events, new filings show. Drug maker Pfizer gave $1 million to help finance the inauguration, according to documents filed with the U.S. Federal Election Commission. Amgen, another pharmaceutical company, donated $500,000. Health insurers Anthem, Centene, and Aetna all gave six-figure contributions. So millions of dollars flowed into the Trump campaign, into the Trump inauguration fund. And I would imagine they continued into his reelection campaign as well, particularly seeing he was hawking about $178 billion vaccination program all for the benefit of the big pharmaceutical companies. Yeah, he knows about those numbers, I bet you. He doesn't know about VAERS. He doesn't know about Israel. But he knows about those campaign cash. I got to tell you, those of you out there who say, well, I really love Donald Trump. We need him back. He's going to save America, except for this one issue. This one issue. Just that tiny little mass experimentation. And now they're coming for our children. I'm supposed to ignore that, right? They are coming at our children at warp speed. I got to tell you, the Trump 2024 people, I love you. Stick around. Hopefully I'll make my case. Now, I don't know if I'm not going to point you to any other savior, because there's no political solution to the problems we have right now. DeSantis isn't going to do it. And DeSantis is one of the best ones out there, right? When it comes to freedom, Ron DeSantis has been knocking the cover off the ball. I'm all for that, but he's got a whole host of baggage with him, too. He's a politician. There is not going to be a politician that comes in here and saves the day, but Donald Trump certainly is not the guy. So you can stick around, or if you can't take it, if you're triggered by my critiques of Donald Trump, then the next few years is probably going to be pretty rough for you when it comes to this show. I'll be right back. All right, we are back. This is the Mike Madison Show, 103.9 WYAB, phone number 601-879-0002. We're going to have Christina Dent on with us next hour. If you are somebody who is open to thinking, you know, Christina talks about a new approach to drugs here in the United States. She's a conservative Christian woman, and she brings facts. So if you want to learn something, she's going to be great. And I'm going to get her to tell. She hadn't been on this show in a while. I'll get her to tell her story on how she even came to this issue, because if you met Christina somewhere, you would not peg her for really a deep dive into the drug war. It's not the vibe she puts off. Super intelligent, super nice lady. Anyway, we'll talk to her next hour, and she brings the facts. She's put out a report that I'm sure she'll tell you how you can get a copy of to find out more about what she's doing, and it's just full of nothing but facts and statistics that really show what a failure the war on drugs has been. She's a great spokesman for it. I'm always excited to have her on the show. I did want to talk about something else. I can continue to talk about the betrayal of Donald Trump on this vaccine issue, one of the biggest issues the United States has ever faced. So those of you who say, well, I really like Donald Trump. He's the greatest president ever, except for that one little issue. You know, the hundreds of thousands of families in the United States that have been devastated by his Operation Warp Speed operation. I mean, outside of that, he's really super duper. You will not find a fellow traveler in me when it comes to that. I didn't want to talk about this, so I'll start bashing the Biden administration. Maybe that'll make everybody feel a little bit better about me. This guy, this Wally Adamo, he's the Deputy Secretary of the Treasury. Obviously, we are a financial train wreck right now, whether it's supply chains or labor markets or inflation. It doesn't matter what it is. And the Treasury, run by Janet Yellen, the former Fed head, the one that made about $7 million talking to the big banks as soon as she stepped down from, air quotes here in the studio, regulating them. This guy's, I don't know, I think he may be second in command at the Treasury, but he was on an interview talking about some of the problems our economy is facing, and he has a solution to it. This is the Treasury Secretary, Assistant or Deputy Treasury Secretary. Just really, this is just a giant word salad of a bureaucrat. And we'll talk about a little bit about who Wally Ademo is.
But Secretary, do you think more could have been done months ago as we started to come out of the pandemic to get ahead of this?
Stephanie, the president has been very focused on this set of issues. We always knew that coming out...
Joe Biden is not focused on anything save maybe lunch.
The pandemic, we would face supply chain issues because reopening up an economy that had been closed down wouldn't be easy. That's why...
Yeah, the economy, you guys closed down. Just to be clear, it wasn't COVID. It wasn't necessary. Plenty of countries didn't shut their economy down, so they create the problem in the first place, but they're laser-focused on how to try to fix it.
When he announced the American Rescue Plan, he included things like the emergency impact payments and the child tax credit in order to make sure that the American people would have the resources to make it through the end of the pandemic.
So, you know, I think it was Harry Brown, the Libertarian candidate for president, who said the government is great at one thing, breaking your leg and then offering you a crutch. And wanting credit for helping you out. So they devastate the economy, and then they send out some $300, $600, $1,200 checks to help you limp along to try to get through the mess that they created.
That we knew would be bumpy because it would take time for our supply chains to catch up with demand in the economy.
But another impact of this backlog is how it's contributed to rising prices. Leaders like Treasury Secretary Yellen and Fed Chair Jerome Powell have said that inflation will be temporary as the economy more fully reopens. But how concerned should Americans be about high prices staying with us longer and eating into their pocketbooks?
Now, get this. This is where the economic illiteracy of the American people comes into play, that this man, who is, again, one of the top guys at our U.S. Treasury Department, when he says this.
Stephanie, you're right that today we face an economy that's in transition. And as part of that transition, we are seeing high prices for some of the things that people have to buy. That's exactly why the president was focused on the American Rescue Plan and ensuring that we got stimulus into the hands of the American people so they'd be able to buy the products that they need.
So let me get this straight. We've got inflation because the Fed keeps printing up endless amounts of money. And to respond to that inflation, they print up endless amounts of money to hand out to the American people to help offset the high prices that were created with that exact policy. I don't even know if that came out right. It's such bizarre circular logic. You print a bunch of money, create inflation, the people suffer, so you print more money so the people can afford the higher prices, and that new money printing creates anyone even higher prices.
But the reality is that the only way we're going to get to a place where we work through,
here it comes,
through this transition is if everyone in America and everyone around the world gets vaccinated.
There's the solution right there. All our economic problems are caused by the rubes out there like myself. I prefer to consider myself a hero in the control group. Someone's got to risk their lives to make sure we're doing an accurate trial study on these vaccines, notwithstanding Donald Trump saying that it was a true monumental achievement to get these things out without any safety testing. I am participating in the safety testing as part of the control group. So there you have it. You got the guy at the Treasury saying, we're going to print up more money to help people because they're suffering because we printed up too much money. Now, it actually gets even a little bit worse here. Some real nut jobbery. And just understand, these people are in charge of the financial fortunes of you, your children, your grandchildren, the entire country.
Having those people pay their fair share of tax.
This is talking about the $600 limit, and they have changed this now. I read an article before I came on air. They are backtracking from this $600 limit to if you run $10,000 through your bank account in the course of a year. Now, they say that they exempt income I'm suspicious of that claim. So they've taken the threshold from $600 a year to $10,000 a year. Basically, 99% of the people in this country run $10,000. I don't care if it's welfare benefits. I don't care if it's a side hustle and you're a student. Just about everybody's run $10,000, but it's more palatable. So the Republicans will stand down now. See, the Republicans got all excited about the $600 limit, and they really opposed it. I oppose it, too. But I oppose the IRS being in any of our accounts at any time. It's none of their business. We are supposedly free Americans who deserve some level of privacy. But they have, they're going to take it up to $10,000. That'll get the Republicans to shut up. The Republicans are absolutely fine if the IRS is nosing around your account, as long as it's not just $600. I mean, that's the line for Republicans. Anyway, so he's talking about this $600 limit. This is before they made the change. This is a couple of days ago.
Having those people pay their fair share of taxes for the things that they use, like our roads and our bridges.
Paid for by gasoline taxes, not personal income taxes.
And the schools that our children go to.
Paid for by property taxes, not individual income taxes.
But why is that threshold set at $600? Why not $10,000 or $50,000 or even higher, so you're only getting...
Or how about you just stay the hell out of our business in the first place? How about that? How about you do nothing? How about we are just free Americans and we transact as we want to transact?
Getting this information on people who are wealthy enough to be avoiding thousands or even millions of dollars in taxes owed.
The reality is that the plan the president has proposed does two things. One, it helps us find the wealthiest individuals who are hiding their income in these financial institutions.
I mean, do you honestly believe this? Be it $600 or $10,000, do you get the idea that that targets the wealthiest among us? And I'm not for targeting the wealthiest among us. I be honest with you, I don't care how crooked you are or how you make your money. There's a lot of cronyism going on that I talk about all the time here. I'm completely opposed to it. The government has become the city of favors. Washington, D.C. is just the city of favors. That's how people become in the billionaire class. You don't do that through hard work and solving problems and creating a good or a service. No, you can only attain that level of wealth in the United States now if you play the game and you are a part of the donor class. But even the most corrupt among them, I'd like to see the government tap shut off so that they're not getting endless amounts of money. But I'd rather see them keep their money than send it to Washington, D.C., even the slimiest among them.
And make sure that they have to pay their taxes. But it also will make sure that those of us who earn an income through a W-2 and pay taxes every 2 or 4 weeks are less likely to be audited, because we'll be able to see the transactions that came in. We'll see the transactions in your account. How much?
Just, you hear what he's saying, right? He's doing you a favor. The IRS is doing you a favor. They're going to be able to monitor your entire financial picture live time to spare you the indignities and the inconvenience of an audit. This is another loving institution in the federal government. They need to spy on you constantly so they know where every nickel that you take in and that you spend goes, so they can spare you the inconvenience of an audit.
How much money you received and how much money you spent over a period of time. That'll mean that for those Americans who are paying their taxes on a regular basis and following the law, they'll be less likely to be audited because of this proposal.
It's all for our own good. Isn't that sweet? We need to spy on you. We need to know. I mean, let's just take this logic down across the board. I mean, why have the police do investigations and have to have suspects? Why don't we just film everything everybody does? It would negate the ability of the possibility of the authorities actually investigating you for a crime you didn't do. We'll just watch you all day long, every day. I mean, they basically do anyway. We'll monitor every single thing you do, and that'll spare you any investigation into you that might be erroneous. We'll just watch every single thing you do. This is your Treasury Secretary. This is the government that we have allowed to be created. There is no political solution to this until people just start saying no. And that's not easy with these things. Baby steps. Let's take over the school boards first. But I got to tell you, this is so out of control. This is the second in charge at the Treasury. Let me tell you a little bit about who Wally Adeyemo is. He was born to Yoruba parents in Nigeria and raised in Southern California. His father was a teacher and his mother was a nurse. Has two younger siblings. After graduating from Eisenhower High School in Rialto, California in 1999, he received a Bachelor of Arts degree from the University of California, Berkeley in 2004 and a Juris Doctorate degree from Yale Law School in 2009. Boy, sounds like such a great success story, right? An immigrant family comes here. The guy knocks the cover off the ball in school. Then he goes and gets his degree, and then he becomes a lawyer at Yale Law School. Really sounds like a true American success story. And then there was this. Adeyemo served as a, and again, this is the second in charge at Treasury, has his fingers all over the strings of finance here in the country. At that great regulator, the U.S. Treasury, Adeyemo served as a senior advisor at BlackRock. Previously, he served as interim chief of staff to the firm's CEO, Lawrence D. Fink. And on August 1st, 2019, Adeyemo was selected as the first president of the Obama Foundation. For all of you Democrats out there that think the Democrats are for the little people. This BlackRock guy, BlackRock, we've talked about a lot over the past few months as they have been scooping up residential real estate, as they have been talking about getting us transitioned into the new clean energy. BlackRock, the world's largest asset manager, the largest financial institution out there as far as assets under management, I believe now around $9 trillion they control. And somehow he finds his way to Treasury. Now, I ask you again, why would a guy from BlackRock in a senior position there, presumably making probably $2 to $5 million a year, why would he leave that career to go to the U.S. Treasury Department where he's probably pulling down maybe $180,000 a year? Does that not seem odd to anybody? Is this guy just such a giver? He wanted to be a servant to the American people. Or is this just more revolving door, BlackRock making sure they've got their plant in at Treasury so they can keep their game going? That is Wally Adeyemo. He's a transplant to the United States, born in Nigeria, a true success story. He learned how to play the game, and he's looting America as a recent immigrant. Holy cow, we are in deep, deep, deep trouble. Be right back. All right, final segment this hour, and then we're going to come back with Christina Dent. She's with the organization End It for Good. We're going to talk about the drug war and different approaches. It's time to rethink some of these things. I think people are more open to it now than they used to be. The failures are quite obvious, and like everything else, I think people are realizing, you know, across the board, it seems like there's an awakening that we've been kind of misled on a few things here and there, maybe taken down the wrong path. Maybe the leaders that we have entrusted for years maybe don't have all the best ideas, so definitely stick around for that. Christina's just a great spokesperson for changing the way we approach drugs here in this country to minimize the harm that it actually does to everybody. But I wanted to get to this story real quick before we head over there. Now, I won't have time for Tech Tuesday this week, but I had some stories picked out, and this was just my favorite, so I wanted to make sure I mentioned this one. They're having a in Glasgow, Scotland, they are having the Conference of the Parties, COPs, Climate Change Conference, hosted by the UK in partnership with Italy. It's taking place in Glasgow from October 31st to November 12th. Now, I've talked about the fact they're pushing us towards these electric cars and everything else. I'm fine with the innovation. I've heard that the electric Porsche is just a joyride. Apparently, it's outselling the traditional 911. So I'm not anybody who would resist that stuff. But we're just not ready for it. Then I'm also not convinced that it does anything for climate whatsoever. Energy has got to be created somewhere. And so even if you get, you know, we've got such vulnerable grids. Can you just imagine if tomorrow they waved a magic wand and said everybody's got to charge their cars? We can't all turn our air conditioners on at the same time these days during the summer. I can't imagine you put the cars on there as well. But anyway, this was kind of funny. So these people are meeting in Glasgow. They've got 20 Teslas to really walk the walk while they talk the talk. They got 20 Teslas at the hotel to shuttle people back and forth from the convention. It's about 75 kilometers. The kicker is that the hotel that they're keeping everybody at that's got these Teslas there, they've only got one Tesla charging station at the hotel. So what do they do then? That's quite a pickle, isn't it? So they've brought in, they've contracted with Glen Eagles. That's the hotel. They've contracted with Malcolm Plant Hire. They're contracted to create to supply diesel generators to recharge the Teslas. So this is your climate change, people. And the same control freaks that think they can control the climate, think that they can control a virus. But again, this is almost more, I guess, virtue signaling, or they didn't plan this out. I don't know. How long does it take to put up a charging station? You would think if you had this conference, maybe you'd do that. But they're using diesel engines to charge Teslas because they love the environment and they want to cut down on CO2. This is pretty indicative of a lot of these things. And again, these are the same people that they'll tell you they can control the environment. They'll tell you they can control the climate. They'll tell you they can control a virus. They cannot do any of these things. All of these things are based on flawed models. If I thought there was a good science around imminent climate catastrophe, I'd be on board. There is no good science in that area. When we come back, we'll be talking to Christina Dent with End It for Good. Please stay with us. Back. This is the Mike Madison Show, 103.9 WYAB. Thanks for joining me today. This is going to be an interesting hour. I hope everybody will stick around and get it. If you don't hear the entire show, this show is podcast. You can go to themikemadisonshow.podbean.com, or you can pretty much find it on most podcast platforms. Just search for The Mike Madison Show, because this is going to be a topic, kind of a deep dive topic. And we've got in studio with us, once again, after a long absence, Christina Dent. She is with an organization called End It for Good, and we're going to talk a little bit about the harms of the drug war itself, maybe a different approach to treating addiction and things like that in society. It's something that definitely needs to be rethought, and I think Christina is one of the best spokespeople out there for it. So, Christina, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me, Mike.
It's been a while.
It has been a long time.
This studio, it was funny. Christina and I were talking before we came on air. The last time you were in here, it was at the very beginning of COVID, and I said something to Christine. I said, "Wow, what do you think about what's going on?" And she said, "What are you talking about?" I said, "There's a virus out there. You haven't heard anything about this virus?" "No, what virus?" And so that shows you how long ago it was.
Wow,
you do know about it now,
yes,
right?
Yes.
You are aware.
I'm apprised now.
Okay. All right. Great. All right. Well, Christina, first I wanted to tell us a little bit about your organization, and then I want you to tell everybody kind of what your story, how you came to this. You're a very conservative Christian woman. Do not put off a vibe at all to be involved in this topic, yet you have dug down into it and done some fantastic work. So kind of what is your organization and how did you get involved in the issue in the first place?
Yeah, so I founded a nonprofit called End It for Good. We've been around for a couple of years here based in Central Mississippi, and we do education and advocacy work around switching from a criminal justice approach to drugs to a health-centered approach to drugs. And I don't mean medicalizing necessarily everything related to drug use, but just moving our processes of thought about how we address drug use and addiction from this kind of punitive criminal justice mindset of let's get law enforcement involved,
right,
to, hey, if somebody has an issue with substance use, maybe we need doctors involved, not law enforcement officers. And so that's really what our work is. It's not up at the Capitol. It really is with the people of Mississippi, and we do some work nationally too, helping people understand what's happening and then helping them understand the root causes of what's happening and what are some options that we can do to get better outcomes related to crime, overdose, incarceration, lots of things that affect us. So for a lot of us, I think people hear the word drug war and we think, like, that doesn't apply to me. Like,
right.
I'm not involved in a drug war.
Right.
And yet, the consequences of drug prohibition, drug criminalization, they are so deeply embedded in the culture wherever you live. All of us are impacted by it, whether or not we've lost somebody close to us to an overdose. It affects every aspect just about of our culture, what we do with drugs and drug policy.
Very, very big issue. So how did you get first involved in this? I mean, this is not something you've been passionate about your whole life.
No, I was pretty passionate in the other direction, actually,
for
most of my life. So grew up in Central Mississippi in Jackson in a conservative Christian home, never used drugs in high school or college. I have a degree in Bible. I became interested in it through becoming a foster parent And prior to that, I had really supported kind of tough on crime, tough on drugs policies. It really seemed obvious to me if drug use is bad, outlawing drugs is the way you fix it. It just seemed so obvious. So through being a foster parent, I met a woman named Joanne who had used drugs while she was pregnant and was not able to beat her addiction during her pregnancy. And so her son was removed from her custody when he was born and was brought to our house, and we became his foster family. And through getting ready to bring him to his first visit with Joanne at the local child welfare office, I pulled up in the parking lot and I popped his car seat out of my van, turned around, and there coming across the parking lot, running full tilt, is Joanne, his mom. This is the first time I've met her. Prior to this, I thought, there's no way a mother who loves her child could possibly use drugs while she was pregnant. Yeah. Like, there's that.
She deserves to lose that child because she must not care.
Yeah. And so here all of a sudden I've got this crashing together of friction between what I have thought about people like Joanne and now what I'm seeing from Joanne. And the more I got to know her, the more I realized she loves her son just as much as I love my three sons. Her addiction is not a lack of love. It's not a lack of desire to be free from it. She was a Christian as well at that time. So it wasn't like all she needed was Jesus kind of thing. Like, it was a really complex crisis of many kinds in her life. But I could see, oh my goodness, if we put her in jail, that's not going to fix it. It's not going to fix her addiction. You know, drugs are readily available in jails and prisons. And it's going to just destroy this little vulnerable family, this mom who desperately wants to be there for her son. And this moment in time that we have of how are we going to respond? Because what we do is going to affect the trajectory of her life and her son's life and this next generation for the rest of his life.
Yeah. And you know, we talk a lot in this society, particularly in conservative circles, about the breakup of the American family. Mm-hmm. I mean, our goal should be to keep families intact, even when they suffer, you know, problems like that. I mean, the ultimate goal should be to have children raised by loving parents and these kinds of things, so that anything we can do to do that would be something that conservatives certainly should be on board with. But there's just an idea, and has been for a long time, that anybody that, number one, you transgress the law, that makes you just a criminal, but also that addicts are really just stupid people who just really don't deserve much of our compassion because they're just so dumb, that kind of thing. But they are regular people, I mean, with emotions, and they're gripped in a disease. So that got you started in kind of researching the topic?
So I kind of dove in. I'm like an avid learner, lifelong learner. I don't like the uncertainty of I'm not really sure what's going on here. I also really enjoy hearing other people's perspectives and trying to learn, even if it's outside of something that I agree with. And so I started reading. The most helpful thing that I read was Johan Hari's book, Chasing the Scream.
Right.
And it's fantastic. We actually, End It for Good started as a series of book discussions on that book. And they just grew and grew, and more people came. And I realized, wow, I would have never thought that there was this kind of hunger in Mississippi for exploring really broad drug policy change. And, you know, the ideas he's presenting in that book as possibilities aren't just taking, you know, one small step. It's saying we need to rethink entirely what we've done with the criminalization of drugs. And that, to me, kind of, I read that book and other resources at the point at which I knew something's desperately wrong. And it's wrong in a way that I could also see it's affecting millions and millions of people. So the degree to which we are wrong is having massive amounts of downstream impact.
Yeah.
And we got into foster care because we wanted to help people. We wanted to help vulnerable children, help vulnerable families. So the thing that really drives me is just that the worst impacts of the drug war fall most heavily on the most vulnerable people, and the people who, many of them, have been harmed the most as children who are suffering the effects of long-term trauma in their childhoods and the self-medication of substance use that progressed into addiction as a result of trauma that was inflicted on them.
Right.
You're right, we don't have compassion for that. We think these are bad people doing bad things, and we fail to see that most of the time these are hurting people trying to feel better. Now, that doesn't mean there's not a lot of chaos associated with an addiction and the way that we handle it right now. But we have to be able to see past it, because if we don't address those root causes, we're just going to keep spinning the wheel and getting the same bad outcomes we've been getting.
Right. And that was one of the best things about, I thought, Chasing the Scream, the book, that when you realize that trauma creates addiction and that our system creates more trauma, which in turn creates more addiction, I mean, it is just a self-fulfilling prophecy we're going to get. And I talk about this topic probably more than people want to hear, because I think it's very important. I think it's important intellectually for people to understand that even something that emotionally you may have a knee-jerk reaction to, we can't do things emotionally. We've tried that for 50 years now. It's just not working. So I talk about this a lot. Who was it that said, basically, if you wanted to create a system to create the most number of addicts, like the worst outcomes with drugs you could, that the American system is pretty much what you would create? Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, Dr. Gabor Maté. Okay. He's done tons of work with addicted people, so kind of the most vulnerable, most addicted segments of the population. And you know, he just has a great way also of talking about, you know, if we think that that trauma works to modify this behavior,
punishment. Yeah.
Can we just look at what we've already inflicted on people? For people who we kind of stigmatize the most, they've lost everything.
Right.
They have no housing. They have lost their bonds with their family. I mean, we have removed everything from their lives. You know, sometimes through consequences of their own choices, but sometimes through our response to those choices.
Right.
You know, we've given them a criminal record. We have,
which makes their future harder.
Yes,
too.
Yes. Yeah. And if you incarcerate someone, I don't think most people really think about what would happen to your family, the listener right now who's listening, if one or both of you, if you're a two-parent household or something like that, were just gone from your life for a couple of months. Like, what would happen?
Yeah.
Your house would be foreclosed on, or you would be evicted from your apartment. You would lose your job. Your life
Health
would
insurance.
Be, yes, yeah. All of it would be gone. And we just don't think about those impacts with the sheer quantity of people that we are arresting right now and putting in jail. Many of them just sitting there waiting for a trial. They haven't even been... There hasn't been no sentencing. They've just been charged with a crime, but they're just waiting for their trial. And if we are thinking as a conservative, thinking about, okay, I want employed citizens providing for themselves and their families. I want strong families like you were talking about. I want engaged people in their communities. This is not helping us get there. It literally is like just dropping nuclear bombs on our communities all the time. Which is not to say that no one should ever be arrested for anything. It's to say that an arrest is a nuclear bomb and should be used very carefully for really serious things that really improve community safety. It's not something that can effectively be used as just a behavior modification tool.
And it is just at the cost of safety. We're going to get into that in just a minute, mm-hmm. because you did a lot of studies about, you know, what actual victim crimes, robberies, rapes, murders, things like that, they don't get solved like they used to because the police are so tied up doing fighting the drug war for a lot of victimless crimes, you know. And we'll get into it. We got to take a quick break. We'll come back. I want to start looking at this report that you've done that looks specifically really at the cost in Mississippi, right?
Yep.
And has that ever been done before that you've known?
Not that we know of.
Yeah, it's very interesting to me. We see a lot of these kind of national figures from people who advocate for changing drug policy, but to really zero in on Mississippi, I thought was very interesting. And I think some of the statistics will be very surprising to people, because mm-hmm. there are a lot of costs to the drug war, to using the manpower and the money and everything else in the drug war. There's consequences to that, to diversion of funds and manpower that could go to other things. I think people will be kind of surprised at the results. So we're talking to Christina Dent with End It For Good. We'll be back in just a minute. Stay with us.
The way I always do. How was I to know? She was with the Russians too.
All right, we are back talking to Christina Dent from End It For Good, Rethinking Drug Policy in the United States, but particularly in Mississippi. So, Christina, you took a look at Mississippi numbers and have put out a report and are going to be having a conference on how it impacts us here in Mississippi. So just crank it up. Tell us what you kind of found with this and what the points you're trying to make and show.
Yep. So as we dive into this, it's probably going to raise a lot of questions for people. So I'll just proactively say what you said. We have a conference coming up November 3rd in Hattiesburg. It's a full day. It's free, open to anyone, endetforgood.com. There's a button on the homepage where you can register for the Shift Summit. We would love to have you. We have speakers coming in nationally, locally, legislators, pastors, lots of people participating with a real broad variety of perspectives. So if you're interested, whether you're a parent who has a child who's struggling with an addiction, or you're a criminal justice professional whose work is impacted, we've tried to cover all the bases and make this really accessible, helpful, and inspiring and hopeful for people.
And this report that you've got, anybody can access that too if they just wanted to go in and read this. It's what, 13-page report?
Yeah. It's at enditforgood.com. Also, right next to the button to register for the conference is the button to download the Misplaced Priorities Report. So we did this because, like you said, there's a lot of national data out there, and there's a lot less kind of state-specific and certainly Mississippi-specific. And we really wanted to dive into, is the drug war working in Mississippi? Is it reducing drug use? Is it reducing overdose deaths? Is it moving us towards public safety and the kinds of outcomes that I think most of us would agree is the goal of the drug war? I mean, the goal of the drug war is to decrease drug use. I think that most citizens would agree.
Sure.
That's the point of it.
Safer streets,
yes,
and all that stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. And so we dove into that, did research on that, and just released this report a couple of weeks ago. And what data shows is that almost 10% of Mississippians over the age of 11 have used illicit drugs in the past month. So when we think about just the widespread use, that's not legal substances. That's not, you know, taking something you got out of your medicine cabinet. This is illegal drugs. Almost 10%. Yes. Almost 10% of Mississippians have used them who are age 12 or older in the past month. Widespread illicit drug use in Mississippi. That's rising. It's risen 33% from 2010 to 2017. It's not decreasing. It's increasing. Drug use is increasing. Addiction, if you just look at the number of Mississippians who have an addiction to an illicit substance, so this is, you know, they've struggled with an illicit drug use disorder in the past year, 58,000 people in Mississippi over the age of 11. And when you look at that quantity of people who, that's not just recreational use, that's people who are have a substance use disorder in the last year to an illicit substance, 58,000 people. Now, I would say that probably is actually a higher number. Anytime you get into illicit numbers, you're, you know, are people wanting to admit that they are addicted to an illicit substance when they're, you know, given surveys and things like that? So I think if anything, we would say it's either that or higher. So we've got all of these people using drugs illegally, thousands, tens of thousands of people addicted to illegal drugs. And yet we have been cracking down and cracking down for decades, you know, 50 years on marijuana since we started the war on drugs and marijuana specifically, 100 years on heroin and cocaine. And yet you can get any of those drugs in any place that you want them, because anywhere that there is demand, there's always going to be supply. And so we have used massive amounts of resources to minimize supply, but it never does anything. Somebody told me one time, I thought this was such a great example. So we kind of see these like drug busts on the news. You know, they've taken so many pounds of fentanyl off the street, or heroin off the street, or marijuana off the street. And there's an attorney in Mexico who said, you've got to understand, cartels are very highly sophisticated business enterprises.
Right.
This is not some guy operating out of his garage. These people are making billions of dollars a year. They know what they're doing. They aren't sitting there going, you know, oh, no, they've taken off, you know, even if it's hundreds of pounds, they work like any other business does, which is they know how much they lose in interdiction, and they ship that much more.
Right.
So that their supply chain is not interrupted because they have shipped enough. And now in the days of fentanyl, which is synthetic, you don't even have to grow an opium poppy anymore to produce fentanyl. You can produce it in a lab. You can produce it out on the, you know, open plains. You can produce it anywhere you want to. It's so incredibly potent that you don't need very much of it to make thousands and thousands of doses. So we still are holding on to this idea that if we just crack down on the supply side, we can just stop people from using. And if you talk to people who actually use and ask them, you know, how difficult is it to find the drug that you want? It's never difficult. There's a guy that was spent many years addicted to heroin, and he said, the longest it ever took me after decades of heroin addiction to find heroin was like 12 hours. And he was like, this was, through all sorts of crackdowns, and it just, anytime there's supply, the demand is always going to be there.
Right.
And we see that increasing, that even though we're cracking down in Mississippi, as with all other states, that we continue to see this drug use rising, lots of addiction, way more addiction than we have capacity to treat right now.
And it's even, you know, up to the point where, you know, it's very romanticized and everything. We take down, you know, Juan Guzman, or we take down Pablo Escobar. Mm-hmm. It's never made a dent in anything. There just then becomes a power struggle. Someone mm-hmm. always steps into this. So even at the biggest operational level, where you would think you go straight to the source and cut the head off the snake, it just turns into four different snakes. Those four snakes go to war, mm-hmm. you know, kill tons of innocent people, and one of them rises again, and they continue the thing. It's not interrupted. And even the police that I've talked to understand that they're not making a difference. And I don't mean that like they don't think maybe they're helping some people, but they know they're not stopping this from occurring.
And I think for a lot of people, I've seen this on many news outlets nationally, that law enforcement are saying, we know that we cannot win this on the supply side. It can only be won on the demand side, because they do understand that the economics of, you know, if there's demand, there's going to be supply. And if we arrest this dealer, then, you know, his friend is just going to be taking over his corner the next day. Or like you said, if we arrest somebody higher up, there's just a power struggle for who's going to take that person's spot.
Right.
And there's a never-ending source of human beings that want money.
Right.
And so it incentivizes this. I think this is another piece that people miss is there's kind of an idea that we have of there's good guys and bad guys. There's criminals and not criminals. And so anybody involved in the illegal drug trade was just sort of born to be a criminal. That's what they wanted to do. That could not be further from the truth. This is an economic reality. People are looking around saying, how can I make money?
Right.
And they're seeing, wow, maybe in my community there's not a whole lot of ways to make a decent living. But if I sell drugs, I can make a really good living.
Right.
This is an economic reality. People are selling drugs. They're getting involved in cartels because there is money to be made in that. And that is economics 101 of anytime you don't allow something to be sold in the legal market and it's popular, the underground market is going to sell it for you.
Every single time.
Every single time.
Yeah.
So the question we have to wrestle with isn't, do we want drugs sold? It's, how do we want them sold?
Right.
Do we want
them
sold?
They're going to be sold.
They are going to be sold. Now, I don't want my kids using drugs, but I recognize also that we have, Johan Hari, actually the author of the book we were talking about, Chasing the Scream, he said, you know, if there's one thing that can be said for the drug war is that we have tried it. I mean, we have gone all in. We have spent over $1 trillion in the U.S. he's talking about. He's not from the U.S., but he's saying, you know, the U.S., out of anyone, has tried this. The Philippines has taken it recently a step further with lots of extrajudicial just murdering people in the streets for drug use. And what's happening there? Is it decreasing drug use? No, for exactly what you said. Drug use is often a response to, you know, numbing the way that you feel.
Right.
And so you increase the trauma in people's lives and you actually increase the addiction. You don't decrease it. So everything that we keep grasping at to try to fix these problems that are very real problems, it's not addressing the cause of those problems. So just like you said about law enforcement, this isn't because law enforcement aren't trying to do a great job at the laws they've been given to enforce and, you know, taking drugs off the street is part of the job that we have given them right now. That's my comments are not in any way to demean that they're doing the job they have been given to do. It's to say you've got to zoom out and say, is that job actually accomplishing the outcomes that we want?
Right.
Is it getting us where we want to go? And like you mentioned earlier, when we use this many resources in one area, those are resources that are not going to be used in some other area.
And particularly now, we know we've got police shortages around the country mm-hmm. right now. I mean, police resources are getting more and more scarce. The time for having this conversation and maybe prioritizing what the police use their limited time for now, particularly, is even more important.
Yeah. One of the really surprising parts of this research that we found was we looked at a 5-year period, 2014 to 2018, at the number of violent crimes and property crimes that were committed during that time period and the amount of arrests that were made also during that time period related to violent and property crime. So
I'll tell you what, Christina, we got to take a break, but yep. I do want to get to those numbers. I think they're important. I don't want to give them a short shrift. So stay with us. We're going to take a quick break and be back with Christina Dent. We'll look at one of the true costs of the war on drugs, and it's not just money or people, but it is the rest of us out here who want safe streets that are also, I mean, we're losing some protection because resources are diverted to this war on drugs. So anyway, talking to Christina Dent, end it for good. Stay with us. We'll be right back. All right, we are back. This is the Mike Madison Show, 103.9 WYAB. We're talking to Christina Dent with End It For Good, Rethinking Drug Policy. And we started talking before the break. There's a lot of statistics that show that with the war on drugs, police resources, which are scarce and becoming scarcer, are diverted into other things where there's a, you know, everybody wants safe streets. We want murderers tracked down. We want, you know, people who assault or rape or kidnap. We want those people tracked down. But, you know, police resources being used in the war on drugs has left us less safe in that area, hasn't it?
Yeah. So one of the things that we looked at in this misplaced priorities report, which people could download at endofforgood.com, there's a button on our homepage. You can go download the full report as well as just a summary excerpt. We looked at this five-year period from 2014 to 2018. No, nothing particular about those 5 years. It just was the five-year period that we could get data for. And looked at the amount of violent crimes that were committed, the amount of violent crime arrests that were made, the amount of drug possession arrests that were made during that same time. Because we wanted to look at, you know, what do we do with our resources? Because like you said, there is a limited amount of resources. You can't do everything.
Right.
And so on the one hand, I would say, well, some of these things, even if you try to do them, they're not going to work anyway, just because it doesn't work. It doesn't work to arrest your way out of addiction just by nature of the fact that it doesn't work. But there are things like violent crimes that all of us want prosecuted, because we do know that the thing that best predicts a deterrent to violent crime is the knowledge that you will be caught.
Right.
So that is the predictor that we know does actually deter people from violent crime. It has nothing to do with sentencing. So you can make longer and longer sentences. That does not impact the amount of violent crime that you see. But whether or not people will be caught does impact whether or not they will commit a violent crime. So in this five-year period in Mississippi, there were 33,000 violent crimes reported. And there were 7,000 arrests made in connection to a violent crime. So that was startling to me.
Yeah.
I think it probably is startling to most people I think the dynamic that happens is we see a high profile violent crime and we also see the arrest, which is similarly high profile. So most of us aren't seeing, you know, we're not seeing 33,000 violent crimes on the news. We see high profile ones and then we see arrests being made. And the assumption, I think, for a lot of us is that violent crimes, by and large, are solved. But the reality is that violent crimes, by and large, are not solved.
It's almost four out of five victims get no justice.
There's no justice for victims of an actual crime committed against them. So that's its own kind of startling statistic. Again, I would say this is not anti-law enforcement. This is just looking at the reality of you have limited resources. Where are you going to spend them? It's also a lot harder to find the perpetrators of violent crimes than it is to arrest somebody for drug possession. As we looked at, you know, almost 10% of Mississippians over the age of 12 are using an illegal drug in the last 30 days. It's much easier to just find one of them because there's, you know, tens of thousands of them than it is to find, you know, the one person who committed this violent crime that you're trying to solve. So there's obviously some challenge there. But during that same five-year period of 2014 to 2018, we arrested 39,000 people for drug possession. So we have 7,000 arrests made in connection to a violent crime, 39,000 arrests made for drug possession. And it's interesting when you look at those charts next to each other, those FBI Uniform Crime Report charts, in the violent crimes and property crimes, there is a, you know, number of violent crimes committed, number of violent crime arrests made, number of property crimes committed, property crime arrests made. You get down to drug possession and there's a missing line in there, which is number of drug possession crimes committed. because it is, it's not against another person. It's just you doing something yourself. And so there's not, nobody is reporting your crime because you're engaging in something you want to do. So you're not, nobody's calling. There's no victim to notify about this arrest that's being made. And so we have lots and lots of arrests being made just for possession. I intentionally am not including the numbers for people selling drugs or trafficking. But just for possession, 39,000 arrests. So if we're thinking about the kinds of things that make our streets safer, and we know that arresting for violent and property crimes is one of the biggest deterrents to violent and property crimes, and yet so many of our resources are going to arresting for drug possession cases and those then getting caught up in the court system, and there's just a massive amount of resources that are going into that. So that's violent crimes, 33,000 crimes to 7,000 arrests.
One thing I'll because I can, I've gotten with the show where I can hear the audience telepathically. And, you know, I think a lot of people would hear some of those statistics and say, well, it's the drugs that's causing that kind of crime anyway. We see the shootings, we see the gang violence, we see these kinds of things. But it's not the drugs causing those things. It's the prohibition of the drugs that creates the street violence that would be, you know, related to gangs or drug warfare or any of those kinds of things. So I think that's one thing to keep in mind. It's almost like COVID didn't shut down the country. The policies surrounding COVID shut down the country. And it's not the drugs that are... Now, there's certainly some people on drugs who do violent things. No doubt about that. These things can put you out of your mind. They're not good substances, but a lot of that violence is actually created by the prohibitionist first, I mean, itself.
Yeah. And if you separate out alcohol from other drugs, alcohol is the primary driver you know, those other kinds of crimes that we think about as somebody taking a substance and then doing something they might normally never do.
Right.
It, by and large, almost all the time, it is alcohol that they have taken, which is already legal and regulated. And we've just tried to mitigate the harms of that. So if you look at property crimes, the number is even starker than violent crimes. So that same five-year period, there were 400,000 property crimes reported in Mississippi and 43,000 arrests for that.
Oh, wow.
So it just in terms of, you know, my car was stolen when I was in college. Nobody was ever arrested for that. They found it on the side of the road, all beat up, you know, a couple of days later. And in my mind, I'm thinking, well, I'm one of the only people, you know, most people kind of get justice. The perpetrators are caught. In this case, it wasn't. And it just is much more frequent than not that, you know, more than 50%, far more, it's almost 80% of property crimes never have an arrest made in them. Again, not because we don't have committed law enforcement officers who are out there doing their very best to make our community safer, but because we have to choose what we're going to spend those resources on. Are we going to spend them on drug arrests or in fighting the drug war? Not just possession arrests, but there's lots of also resources that go into, you know, trying to combat the gang and cartel aspect of the whole drug trade and all of the violence that's associated with that. We have to make choices about what we want to do. What do we want to spend our resources on? And whether or not we want to spend them on the things that really make our streets safer, just ending prohibition would remove a lot of the crime and violence from our streets because
as
so much
it did
of it
in
is,
Chicago in the 1920s when they repealed prohibition. Those things all went away.
Yeah, so a lot of it, ending that would end a lot of the crime and violence, period. But the resources that are left for law enforcement could then be spent on the things that really are going to help us have safer communities, solving more violent and property crimes to give those victims justice and also to deter future people who know, you know, the hope would be that it would become a world where we say, I'm not going to do that because there's a 90% chance I'm going to get caught. Instead of right now, just statistically, I'm not being mean, I'm just saying statistically, there's a very good chance you won't be caught a property crime, which is unfortunate because I think it leaves a lot of people without justice and it leaves a lot of people frustrated with law enforcement, which is also, to me, very unfortunate. I'm a pro-law enforcement person. They're very frustrated with just the lack of support that many of them are feeling from the community. There are things we can do that will fix that and will help to restore some of that trust and real just pro-law enforcement sentiment that as people see, yes, we're really focusing on the things that are going to make
protecting
our streets
safer.
People. Yes.
Not policing personal behavior.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay. We got to take another break. When we come back, well, let's touch kind of on the conclusions of this and what you would say is a better approach to what we're doing. We'll cover any other statistics that you've gotten from Mississippi and the cost to us. And then we'll talk a little bit about your conference and your work here. I need to have you back for like 2 hours. We need to take phone calls because I can already hear.
Yes.
You know, there's so many obvious questions. Even as somebody who has been, you know, opposed to the drug war now for probably 15 years now, I can hear my former self sometimes when something comes up thinking, this is what I would have thought back then. So I'd love to have you in for a call-in session, too. We're talking to Christina Dent, End It for Good, talking about rethinking drug policy here in Mississippi in particular. We'll be right back. All right, we're back. Final segment here with Christina Dent from End It for Good. Again, we could do 2 hours, 4 hours, 6 hours. It's such a great topic. So, Christina, tell us a little bit, any other statistics you got from your report and what, you know, what your group looks at for an alternative to the current, you know, lock them up, try to control the supply, the failed approach we've had to the war on drugs so far.
Yeah, I think one of the most concerning things for people right now is what's happening with overdose rates. More and more people know either family members or family members of people they love or people they went to college with who are losing loved ones to overdose. And those overdose numbers in Mississippi have just continued to rise. So we had a 40% increase in overdose deaths from 2011 to 2019. From 2019 to 2020, just in 1 year, that's up at least 14%. The final numbers have still not come in for 2020. So we're seeing this. If you see it on a chart, the overdose death rate is just skyrocketing. That curve is just going nearly vertical. That's because contamination from fentanyl on with drugs on the street. I think it's important to say there are loads of people using fentanyl all the time that know they're using it that aren't dying from it. It is not that if you get fentanyl, you will die. Fentanyl is in most street drugs at this point. There's, you know, tens of thousands of people using them every day who aren't dying. But the reality is that it's very easy to die when you're using such a potent substance.
Right. There's no room for error.
There is no room for error there. And so we have this huge opioid-heavy increase in overdose deaths, primarily driven by fentanyl that people are getting on the streets. This is not something that you got from your doctor and you're overdosing and dying on.
And real quick, fentanyl is a consequence of the drug war because they want the most potent thing in the most smallest packages that make it more easy to smuggle.
Yep. Yeah, yes. So. Which is interesting because I heard an interview the other day and the host was saying, you know, it must be just because cartels want to get people addicted to the most potent thing. That must be why they're, you know, putting fentanyl in these other drugs. That's not why.
No.
It's because fentanyl is more potent, so it can be smuggled more easily because you have to smuggle a lot less of it than you do of heroin. It is a purely economic decision, and it will continue. We will get more potent drugs than fentanyl. It is the iron law of prohibition. It's always going to get more and more potent because you have that risk factor of smuggling.
Right.
So if we want to address overdose deaths in Mississippi and across the nation, we have to face what's causing them, which is the unregulation of substances on the street that are contaminated with more and more deadly substances. And, you know, expanding treatment is great. That's not going to fix fentanyl on the streets. Giving people, you know, not putting people in jail, good. Not going to fix overdose deaths on the streets. If we want to fix this overdose death crisis, we have to figure out how to get people to stop using substances that are contaminated. And to do that, we're going to have to release some sort of pressure valve for them to access them in some sort of legal way, either under medical care, maybe remove prescribing restrictions that have pushed so many people to the street who have been using, you know, legally regulated substances. So that's a huge deal. That's just, in my mind, I don't see any way that that's going to not continue to go higher and higher until we're willing to face what's causing it, which is not prescriptions. It's the unregulated nature of drugs on the street.
Right. Yeah. All right. We've only got about 2 minutes left. This has absolutely flown by. So tell us whatever you got 2 minutes worth of.
Yep. So there is hope. We can misplaced priorities report, endit4good.com. We give a couple of options: reclassifying drug offenses, moving away from felonies for drug offenses so that we can stop destroying people's lives unnecessarily for their futures. We can, you know, reallocate resources towards treatment and harm reduction services, expanding pre-arrest diversion programs, intervention courts like drug courts. But I see kind of still that the elephant in the room is, why are all of these harms happening? And so much of it comes back to prohibition. And that's the elephant in the room we've got to face, is the cause of a lot of these problems. So if you're interested at all, come on down to Hattiesburg, November 3rd. It's going to be fantastic. We have four of our legislators are joining us on a legislative panel, three Republicans, one Democrat. And they're not saying that they agree with us on all of our ideas about drug policy. They're saying this is important. We're engaged. We need to be talking about how we can find a better path.
Well, I think
forward.
It's so important that you've done this Mississippi-centric report. That should open up a lot of eyes, because I'm sure even lawmakers aren't familiar with everything you've mm-hmm. covered.
Yeah. So we've got a legislative panel, criminal justice panel, a faith panel with pastors talking about how churches can be places of hope and healing for families struggling with an addiction or people trying to walk in long-term recovery. And then we have three keynote presentations. So we're doing addiction, what it is and what it isn't, with Dr. Kent Dunnington coming in from Biola University, Angela Mallett presenting on harm reduction rather than punitive approaches to how we think about substance use, and then Trevor Burris from Cato Institute coming in to talk about exploring legal regulation. It's going to be a fantastic day. Register at endit4good.com. Join us for a day of hope and inspiration and a lot of big ideas.
Well, great. Christina, you're doing fantastic work. We're going to have you back. Everybody, thanks for joining us. Check it out. End It For Good. They are doing good work.
No
See you tomorrow.
Matter
Bye-bye.
How hard you try, you can't stop us now. No matter how